Hello and welcome to the Ship Energy Podcast with me, Ariane Morrissey. With IMO member states set to meet again to discuss the future of the net zero framework at MEPC 84 at the end of the month, we're asking what potential directions the debate could take and what the possible outcomes of the meeting would mean for the shipping industry. I'm joined by Evelyn Williams, Research Associate at the Center on Global Energy Policy, which is part of Columbia University in New York. In addition to her current research on trade policy, she also has a unique perspective, having been a part of the US delegation to the International Maritime Organization, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, and the OECD between 2023 and 2025. Welcome to the podcast, Evelyn.
Thank you, Ariane.
So if we look at the documents submitted by countries ahead of MEPC 84, they give us a fairly good idea of the state of play right now. The two main camps, we could say, are no surprise, with the United States and petrostates leading the charge against the net zero framework, while on the other side, Brazil and Pacific Island states want its adoption. So what do those documents reveal about those countries' red lines, how the positions of the main voices in favor and against the NZF have perhaps evolved, and what are likely, in your opinion, to be the most contentious points during those negotiations?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the submissions ahead of this session give us a pretty candid picture, as you said, of where delegations stand. Certainly more candid than we often have at this stage. And while that certainly doesn't reflect the simplicity of the negotiation, it certainly makes my job easier in describing it. So as you mentioned, the adoption camp here wants the existing text moved forward without substantive alterations. The Pacific Island states have introduced contingency amendments where they would increase ambition if the text is reopened. But that threat is relatively hollow. They lack the procedural leverage to force higher ambition unilaterally. And if reopening becomes the de facto outcome, which I think it is, quite frankly, I think it reveals a real risk of isolation. We saw the island states walk out of the session in protest of the 2023 strategy. And if that happens again, their position is likely closer to the termination camp than they perhaps want to be. Brazil and Solomon Islands here occupy a more pragmatic position, focused on process and implementation timelines rather than pure textual maintenance, so to speak. But they maintain a form of optimism, I think, that's pretty quickly lost elsewhere, which is a good segue into talking about the opposition, specifically from the petrostates you mentioned. They're calling for a framework with no centrally administered pricing and no mandatory financial mechanism. The United States goes further, as we know and you might expect, explicitly calling to cancel the next session alongside a number of heavy red lines, but perhaps we can dive into that a bit later. As an aside, I think the U.S. submission is likely the most colorful language we've ever seen in an IMO document to date. If you haven't had the good fortune to read a technical submission before, I assure you the depth of their usual dryness is a little bit of a feat. But what's significant about the petrostate bloc is up until this point, they've been relatively quiet. And you can see a pretty clear emboldening of their positions under the U.S. influence. I'll offer a little bit of caveat here to say that I think the vast majority of what does happen at MEPC 84, submissions aside, will depend on how seriously delegations take U.S. pressure and if there is sustained U.S. pressure in the first place. And right now, the conflicts in Iran has sharpened energy market dependencies in ways that give the U.S. via its LNG market considerable leverage over a number of delegations that might have otherwise held firm. We saw just a few days ago that to be the case with the EU, right, with threats against withholding U.S. LNG in order to see the U.S.-EU trade deal ratified. So within that context, states that are kind of simultaneously managing energy security concerns and trade relationships with Washington are not negotiating from a position of comfortable independence. At the same time, states want to see a regulation manifest. This has been in the works for 20 or so years. So if we do see an outcome, I think it'll fall somewhere in the middle of the two camps we discussed, with a primary focus on the economic element in its entirety.
We'll get back to the US position in a second, but I also want to look at the proposals that are trying to find bridges or compromises. So there was notably a submission by Liberia, Panama, Argentina, and another one by Japan. So what do those countries suggest exactly as a compromise or a middle path?
So both proposals are trying to solve the same political question from slightly different angles. The Liberian proposal submitted by Argentina, Liberia, and Panama goes furthest in restructuring the framework. It does a couple things, and bear with me. When I say a couple things, it does a lot. It removes remedial unit pricing. It keeps the surplus unit trading architecture. It replaces the fixed reduction trajectory with one derived from commercial fuel availability and price limits, and eliminates the IMO fund entirely. It kind of endogenizes the market, the unit market, to operators. So the targets only tighten as fast as when the IMO would deem a fuel to be affordable. So that's within the 15% margin of a VLSFO price per ton, what they deem available, which they define as holding 5% of the current market share, and scalable. So those are fuels expected to have a 5% share or more in the next 5 years of the total market. It's pretty substantive, a pretty substantive alternative, and people have reacted pretty viscerally to it. The big rub is no what we call near zero fuels are anywhere close to those thresholds. Methanol is about four times the price of VLSFO per ton, for example. And what does make it in those thresholds at the moment is LNG, which offers around a 10% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions with the downside of methanol leakage. So you can see why climate proponents aren't exactly thrilled. And on the Japan side, suggestions, I'll avoid calling it a proposal for now. They were pretty specific with that language. It keeps the framework architecture, but it suggests removing the so-called mandatory payment to the fund by allowing Tier 1 deficits to be balanced with surplus units rather than cash contributions, and proposes recalibrated targets using updated transport data and assumed 15% efficiency improvement, which seems niche, but it's essentially lessens stringency across the board. Japan also flags the LCA guidelines as a key instrument, arguing that LNG's well-to-wake GFI value should be reassessed. That's, you know, their overall greenhouse gas fuel intensity value, which matters a lot for target setting. And it's a point the U.S. submission echoes in its call for technological neutrality. Others will read that as a bit of pandering to the pro-LNG side of the house, but it still leaves the fund in place, which remains a red line for many.
How likely is either proposal to achieve that consensus that has been quite elusive in October?
Yeah, I think consensus, as in the classical IMO sense of everybody agreeing, is pretty far-fetched. That said, Japan's proposal is the more pragmatic vehicle. It doesn't require rebuilding the architecture, and it directly addresses the two complaints that carried the most weight in October, the fee system and the target feasibility. The Liberian proposal is more conceptually coherent, in my view, but it asks more of delegations that spent years negotiating the current text. The risk with both is with the developing state parties, whose support for the original framework was premised on the fund providing some form of substantive project financing. You know, when you remove the fund, you need to offer something in its place. Neither proposal does so, so you're only really banking on the assumption that if you take an attenuated framework in its place, in place of the last, that it's better than a series of regional alternatives. Otherwise, there's nothing worth continuing, frankly.
Both proposals, to some extent, would dilute the level of ambition or get rid of the fund. So from a climate perspective, how effective would those proposed new frameworks be at reaching those objectives in the IMO revised strategy of decarbonizing shipping by or around 2050?
Yeah, I mean, I think the strategy has been abandoned a little bit. I don't even hear people referencing the 2050 goal anymore, which is unfortunate. And I think both carry real risks of under-delivering as a greenhouse gas mechanism. Japan's revised targets and assumed 15% efficiency improvement might remain nominally aligned with those checkpoints, but those assumptions are optimistic, and a flat direct compliance target through 2035 essentially removes near-term pressure on the fleet. But that doesn't mean it can't be strengthened, right? The Liberian proposal's market-linked trajectory could be gentler in practice, especially if only LNG and the conventional fuels clear the commercial viability thresholds for the first review period, which seems to currently be the case. The trajectory barely would move. What the Liberian proposal essentially does is transfer the decarbonization obligation from the regulator back to the market. And that can work, but only if capital flows into green fuel production at the scale and speed required. The problem is that the investment case is circular, right? You need regulatory certainty to justify the capital, and the Liberian framework provides certainty about process, but not really about outcomes. It's in some ways like a game theory problem. You know, you are being asked to commit billions to a product whose commercial viability depends on no other player arriving first with a cleaner alternative that renders yours obsolete. So your highest reward and highest risk move is to invest heaviest in zero to near zero fuels. I suspect, however, that absent pretty sustained investment by governments, that might not move the needle.
And now, obviously, there's the documents, the submission, but another important aspect is what actually happens during the meeting. And you've referenced it earlier. A big question is what the United States will do this time. So you were part of the US delegation to IMO in 2024 and 2025 during your time at the US Department of State. What do you think their objective and their approach is going to be?
Yeah, that kind of is the central question. And I don't have a super fun response. I think, you know, we've heard a lot of rhetoric on this front. We've heard the regulation being called a tax and a scam and whatnot. And, you know, there's obvious reasons for that. You know, denouncing a global carbon tax is a little bit easier on the news than a nuanced discussion of tramp operator compliance pathways, for example. But the rhetorical volume has kind of had the effect of making people assume that the U.S. opposition is purely ideological, and I don't think that's necessarily the case. And to that point, I'll just provide a little bit of nuance here to say that certain U.S. export industries, but particularly low-value bulk commodities along trans-Pacific routes, face pretty genuine competitive exposure in the framework's early years. Partly because the tramp operators serving those routes have limited near-term access to compliant fuels, and partly because of U.S. geography. In markets where buyers are allocating on marginal cost differences, that asymmetry has consequences that are disproportionate to the sector's share of national GDP. And I'm not saying here that Wall Street is running off wood chips and agriculture, for example, but there are some pretty micro policy issues at play. And it doesn't help that the IMO impact assessment predicted U.S. GDP losses in the range of $400 billion in 2031 under a comparable mechanism. So objecting to that is not irrational per se, but the strategic picture kind of cuts the other way. The U.S. leads in biofuels and LNG, so walking away from IMO means ceding the regulatory environment in which those fuels will compete globally to others who are actively writing rules, you know, designated to exclude them. See the fuel EU, right? The administration's own very Mahanian maritime action plan talks about reclaiming U.S. dominance at sea. I think In my view, the IMO framework shaped by U.S. participation is arguably the most direct path to doing that, and the fuel market that will actually matter. So whether Washington can kind of hold that longer-term calculation alongside the near-term political pressure is a real question. At the same time, I wouldn't be surprised if we saw another politically driven response, if only to drive the point home of protecting American supply chains, especially within the context of the conflicts in Iran. But we'll see.
Interesting, because obviously the Trump administration has made its view on the Net Zero framework quite clear, but from where you're sitting, how is it perceived more broadly in the United States, especially by ship owners and producers of LNG and biofuels?
It's quite complex. The US is of course quite politically varied, and the topic remains pretty obscure, I'd say. The majority of the public's introduction to it was within the context of kind of the polemic framing as a global UN tax by the president in October. That said, the internal divisions are significant. The biofuel and ethanol sector, which carries considerable political weight in US farm states, has been among the most vocal domestic of the domestic constituencies pushing against the administration's position. And they argue that the framework represents a really enormous and largely uncaptured market opportunity for American agricultural producers. The LNG supply chains and most internationally operating ship owners would similarly, or they seem to similarly prefer regulatory clarity, it seems. And certainty that termination would produce. Again, the rhetoric about regional systems here keeps coming up. But the administration's position reflects a particular coalition of interest, not necessarily the unified American industry view.
And now you've mentioned it, a lot of what might happen could be political posturing. And, in the US submission, we see a list of demands for any regulation on GHG, namely no economic penalties, no fund, no disadvantage for any fuel type, phasing out EU ETS, and an explicit acceptance procedure. Do you see this as the administration trying to kill any meaningful global regulation? Or do you think they're starting with high demands and could perhaps allow a watered-down framework to pass?
There's something strategically revealing about stating your red lines that openly. It's not conventional diplomatic practice, and it creates real exposure, right? Once you've declared your limits in writing, every other delegation can model your position and probe its edges, and that cuts both ways. The pessimistic reading is that it is a baseball bat blocking strategy dressed up as engagement, where conditions are set precisely because they cannot be met, with the framework's failure as the attended outcome. The more optimistic reading, and the one I lean towards, is that it represents a genuine, if narrow, opening, a US administration willing to articulate the conditions under which it could accept a regulation. Is at minimum a US administration that has not closed the door entirely. And that is a different posture than October. The Liberian proposal is, in many respects, kind of a direct attempt to thread that needle again. The fixed trajectory it proposes would likely favor transitional fuels with existing commercial scale. But the explicit acceptance procedure remains unsolved, and that's not a minor point. But the distance between the US red lines and the Liberian text is smaller than the distance between the US and the original framework. But again, what the US red lines allow is the opportunity for other countries to weigh the potential cost of disagreeing with the US on these points. To circulate a text, not to amend it, you just need simple majority, which I think is attainable in a few directions, depending on the relative bravery of member states to contest with the administration.
And we know that in October, the threats of retaliations, tariffs, sanctions from the United States played a huge role in the outcome of that meeting, the adjournment of the extraordinary MEPC session. But in the meantime, there have been judgments at the Supreme Court against the blanket tariffs imposed by President Trump. As you mentioned, there's the whole conflict in the Middle East that's also playing a role. So do you think the US will have the same power this time?
Well, the Supreme Court ruling has knocked down the power of the president had to say, vote no or see immediate tariffs. It doesn't change that the president can impose sanctions on individual negotiators or make energy-related threats, as we've seen again with the threats against the union. I think the energy tactics are almost scarier in that it's unclear the extent to which the president has the authority to manipulate private long-term contracts. So the power has changed, but perhaps not to the benefit of those potentially under threat.
The European Union and China used to play a very prominent role in the discussions around the midterm measures. Do you think they're also likely to be power brokers this time around?
Well, both the EU and China played quite a technical role formerly in the negotiations. I think the extent to which they'll re-engage lies again with their willingness to butt up against the US. On the side of the EU, the administration claimed that the net zero framework is, and I quote, a neo-colonial European mechanism to impose standards on developing countries, which I think is hilarious. And the admin has also made the assertion that the mechanism will ultimately benefit China. One point is a little more nuanced than the other, and for the sake of time, I'll hold my urge to get into the analysis there. But both parties are in a unique position in that if they do re-engage, it very well might add fuel to the fire in a way that hurts the likelihood of the framework going forward before it progresses it. It'll be interesting to see if Britain follows the EU suit there, but I digress. And to your question, you might expect a quiet expression of brokerage, if anything. I'll just add that the EU as a climate ambitious bloc has historically managed the request of the island states. So it'll be interesting to see how that manifests if they choose to disengage.
So do you expect the EU to be less vocal this time in its support of the net zero framework?
I think so. I think with the trade deal ratified, or at least voted upon, a lot more is at stake. They're in kind of a fragile position with the US, especially with the threat of its, the LNG market overhead. So I think they will be quite quiet. And I think that'll further isolate the islands in a way that's not necessarily helpful in prompting climate ambition, so to speak.
And to finish, in terms of the likely outcomes of MEPC 84, what would the best case and the worst case scenario look like?
I think that depends on who you are in the game. For a ship owner operating a modern LNG fleet, the Liberian framework may look more attractive than the original. For a CIDS negotiator, that's obviously not the case. An ambition cut and the removal of the fund defeats the purpose entirely. But stepping back from the individual positions, I think the worst case scenario here is straightforward, and that would be if the framework is abandoned entirely. So that's the Gulf States proposal, right? Flawed as it is, this text has been decades in the making, and losing that progress would be deeply detrimental, if only to my spirit and the spirit of the negotiations past. But the best case is that some substantive form of the mechanism survives and it's iterated upon over time. Avoiding equivalent regional systems here is key. And again, you've heard that many times, and I'm sure I'll say that again. But what makes the negotiation particularly consequential is that it kind of sits well beyond the shipping sector. It's in some ways a bit of a microcosm of a much larger question about whether multilateral institutions can still produce substantive outcomes at all, which seems dramatic, but if the US does decide to kill this thing, that precedent will certainly reverberate down the line.
And from the industry perspective, you know, when we talk to ship owners, fuel producers, people who are involved across the supply chain, the key thing we hear today is that there's a lot of uncertainty in them being able to make investments towards decarbonization in shipping. Do you think that MEPC 84 is likely to bring any clarity to the industry?
That's a great question. And I think it's going to leave most questions unanswered. I don't think we're going to get a clear signal of what the next few years of investments will be pointed towards. I mean, when we look at the order book now, I think there's a pretty clear trajectory towards decarbonization, which is really encouraging. But again, with the threat of being a ship operator and having to manage different regional systems, managing both the costs associated with that and finding appropriate fuel arrangements is really complex and undesirable. So the extent to which the industry on its own will coalesce around, you know, a set outcome is something else. But we'll see. I don't think April is going to give us what we're looking for.
Thank you very much, Evelyn.
Thank you.